was a point where I decided to just do what I felt like I was best at, and I've stuck with that really for the last decade or so. And so I'm in the fashion world, but I'm not, as it were, you know, one of those people that is always doing a new thing.
I am Susie Menkes, and you are listening to my podcast, Creative Conversations. As a journalist reporting on the global fashion industry, I want to take you backstage and give you an insight into my world. Listen to my exclusive conversations with creatives, industry leaders, and those whose voices have some of the greatest impact. I think you might find it interesting and maybe intriguing. In this episode, I have a quiet and intimate conversation with designer Bella Freud in her London store. Her extraordinary life, beginning with her free spirit childhood in Morocco, against a towering family history that includes Austrian Sigmund Freud, the founder of psychoanalysis, and her surrealist artist father, Lucian Freud. On that backcloth, Bella has drawn a life in fashion. Let's hear about a passion for the 1970s, to a very personal, even secret way of telling her fashion story in clothes of today. Bella Freud, I'm so pleased to be here and to see you. And here we are in your London store. Well, I'm not sure I call it a store. It's a kind of secret place, which has got a lot of your life and everything in it, and a lot of really great clothes. But it's not on the normal drag in London. It's a little bit off the track. And in a way, perhaps that's something to do with your character. But anyway, it's great to come in here, and great to see you, and doubly great to have a chance to talk to you.
Well, you're so welcome, Susie. It's lovely to have you here in my sort of second home. You're so perceptive about all the underlying things, and that's exactly how I wanted my shop to be, like an extension of my home.
I'm rather interested. I find it quite intriguing that you did create another kind of life and history, this whole thing of the 1970s. And can you also tell my listeners about the slogans you put on your clothes, a kind of fashion text message that's become part of your fashion spirit? How did it begin, and how are you still developing now these names now that are part of your history as a designer?
Well, the 70s, I'm not even especially fascinated by it, but it just happened to be the time when my aesthetic was influenced, because that's when I was becoming a teenager. And also, I think, because I went to this progressive school called the Steiner School, where they seemed to specialise in drab clothing, and then I would see the teachers sort of waffling around in like drooping cords, and they wore Birkenstocks, which it took me decades to come around to that. I hated them with a passion, and they seemed to represent ugliness and, you know, no style. So, and then I'd see local young people dressed up to the nines in platform shoes and these full-on outfits and all the pop stars. So there was a real conflict of, I don't like eschewing this fashion, but I don't want to be part of it because there's something slightly ridiculous. And then the snobbism from my school that if you were interested in your appearance, you were vain. But I also figured out that there was something very important about how you dressed to save yourself in a weird way from being, you know, just part of, I didn't want to be part of the Steiner movement. I wanted to protest against it. And that's also where my interest in words came from, because being a spindly little girl, I realised language was where I had power and became very interested in words and how they kind of affected your emotions independently of context. And that's where my words on my sweaters come from, sort of like from the protest movement, how one word can be just so evocative. And I'm still really interested in that.
Interestingly, I think you seem to have
been very original in everything that you did. I mean, take this store where we are now. It's kind of slightly hidden. It's not hidden, but it's on a part of London, central London, that a lot of people wouldn't automatically come by. And we're in Marylebone, which you've obviously chosen. So why did you have this enthusiasm for this area where we're sitting now?
Well, I looked around and various places, and a friend of mine, Maria Lemos, she has a little shop further down the street on the main drag. She said, you have to move here. And there was a few places available, but this was the nicest one. So even though it's rather annoyingly, you know, you have to come here rather than just happen to walk past, I do seem to set myself up slightly without intending to be a bit hidden. I suppose it's part of my personality. I like to be slightly behind the scenes, but not invisible. And also Marylebone, my father used to take me for, when I was a very young teenager, it was the area for all the Jewish refugees to have patisseries like Patisserie Sanya. We used to go there, and they had these amazing things that I'd never tasted before, these Danish pastries. I mean, it was so delicious. It was just sort of, his brother used to be there reading the racing news, Stephen, who had a shop that sold doorknobs in Chilton Street. So it kind of has that background, which I quite like. And here I am.
If I stand in your London store, would I be able to see things that are elements of your Freudian ancestry or of your Jewish background, although quite distant for you? Do you analyse your own family history and immerse yourself in that, in the psychology and the art? Or is it just happens organically?
I do feel it there. And I suppose until I was very kind of focused on my father, we all were, because there he was, and he was so dynamic and he was so interesting. And then I got more interested in Sigmund Freud when my son brought a comic book home, a graphic novel called Freud or something. Anyway, it was incredibly well done and very entertaining. So I read all that. And I've always been interested in what's underneath and reading people. I suppose part of my childhood was trying to find out what was happening in, you know, with unpredictability and things. So I feel like that side of me is very attuned, that sort of getting a reading and figuring out where people are in terms of their mood and their kind of level of upsetness.
You seem to me to have various layers or areas, I don't know how to describe it, in your whole personal history that is exceptional in a way. I mean, you spent two of your younger years with your mother and sister in Marrakesh, in Morocco. That's right, isn't it?
Mm.
Sitting in the store right now, I can't really feel any of that, not anything of Morocco, except perhaps a faint scent of an oud candle somewhere in a corner.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some oud lurking around somewhere. But I think living in Morocco sort of educated me in a lot to do with clothing and how people respond to you because of what you wear. And I was six when I went, and I learned Arabic very quickly in the local French dialect, and I dressed as a little Arab girl, and all my friends were the beggar girls in the square, so I just hang around with them. And I got this sort of sense of how people respond to each other, and I liked that very much, and I had a lot of sympathy for, and even though I didn't really understand it, but you know, we were all these tiny children, and there was no one much looking after anybody, but we kind of looked after each other. And I saw that I had an advantage, you know, because of not being a little Arab girl. I was a little English girl, you know, even though I could pass for one. And I like that. I like being in people's worlds and having, you know, as little divide as possible.
Can you still speak these languages? Do you still have...
I wish I could speak Arabic, but I had no one to practice with when I got home to London. I remember bumping into a boy in the playground, but he spoke a different dialect. Moroccan dialect is completely different from what's considered proper Arabic. But I still speak French, I speak Italian, I, I speak a bit of German. I did an exchange and they stayed, but...
Well, I'm pretty impressed by this because as far as I've understood it, you actually were brought up in the English countryside when I don't think that there's much in the way of language that one hears. Did you love it? Was it wonderful to be in the countryside or did you actually want to get back? Because you'd had such an exciting life up to the age of about 7. Mm. It must have been rather strange to go very quiet and English countryside and...
Well, it certainly wasn't traditional. I mean, we didn't have anywhere. We didn't have our own home. We moved. The first 2 years, we moved 11 times in 2 years. And so nothing was kind of settled. But the only thing, my mother had this idea that she wanted us to go to this school. And we went there and they were big on languages and on Greek mythology. Didn't learn a lot else, but actually that served me quite well. I love Greek mythology and, you know, interest in kind of literature, and those were the things that I liked. And
what about your interest in fashion, really, from quite an early stage? I mean, I find that quite impressive. Aren't I right in thinking that you actually studied fashion design in Roma, and
yes.
That was the beginning, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the beginning really was working for Vivienne Westwood. When I worked in seditionaries when I was 16 or 17, and I got the job. I was sort of lurking on the fringes of people who she liked, young people, and who worked for her. And then one day I had waist-length hair and I cut it off to an inch short, and she gave me the Saturday job. And then I worked there, and I really got this sense of the power of clothes, how they affected other people. And I'd always known that there was a certain way, thing to do with clothing that made me feel safe and made me feel kind of armoured up in a soft way. So I knew that clothes were important to make me feel sort of at ease and then sort of not preoccupied. And then my language would come to play, which I felt was my kind of modus operandi, you know, but that was my way of getting through life.
It was nearly a decade later, wasn't it? You must have been nearly 30, I think, if I added it up right, that you decided to go your own way. You started your company in 1990, and you were aged nearly 30, quite old for the fashion world in England. How did that all come about when you were on the London Fashion Week calendar and so on? Now I suppose we'd say that you've got a much more personal approach and a much slower attitude. I don't mean slow in the way of not getting on with it, but you perhaps more thoughtful now and do things more slowly, is that right?
Yeah, it is. Luckily for me, the whole fashion system has changed so much where, you know, when I first started my label, it was, you know, and what I'd learned from Vivienne and just being in the fashion world was that you were always making something new. And gradually over the years that's changed, where even the thing of redoing a jumper, I remember doing Ginsburg is God and Je T'aime Jane, the sort of early word sweaters, and that stylist Camille Bideau Waddington saying, "Why, well, do it again, of course you should do it again." And you know, people didn't repeat things in those days, and now it's completely normal, and that's the way to sort of, you build on that too. And then at a certain point, I mean, there were things like grunge and that droopy style of dressing. Every time I tried to do something like that, it would just end up being tight-fitting. I just couldn't do that. And so there was a point where I decided to just do what I felt like I was best at. And I've stuck with that really for the last decade or so. And so I'm in the fashion world, but I'm not, as it were, you know, one of those people that is always doing a new thing.
So you are quite extraordinary in that you took in so many different languages, particularly when you were very young. But you're very much a speaker of Italian. And has that helped you? Has that helped you make the clothes? I mean, everybody always says that the Italians are the people who are the most skillful, but that it's often difficult to talk with them. But you have managed to get over that, yes?
Well, yeah, when I worked for Vivian and she was being produced by Staff International, this amazing Italian company, the pattern cutter didn't speak that good English, but it was really useful. And all the people in the local factories, I could communicate really well. And it's so much to do with, you know, kind of nuance and can you change this stitch to that? And can you get this, that, and or do, you know, it's so specific, all about detail of fabric content. And so it was very relaxing. And also I felt very welcomed because I could speak the language. And then when I was trying to persuade people to do things for me, you know, when I was doing my own line with Staff for a little bit, and my nickname used to be E Possibile, because I would start everything trying to wangle some extra tiny bit out of it. But really,
you knew sort of English charm, being very polite, and would it be possible, exactly, translated as get on with it and do it for me?
You know, trying to sort of wheedle something more when they'd already said no, or the time deadline had gone wrong, or I'd maybe forgotten something. And then I could ring up the factory and just sort of convey the desperation of how important this was. So, and really, any communication is everything. So if you can speak someone else's language, it's a real sort of mark of respect that, you know, especially as us English, we just expect everyone to speak English. And many people do. So it's nice to be able to show that you care about, you know, making an effort for them. And it's exciting, you know.
I was in Paris a couple of weeks ago and I saw Natasha Fraser, who's a friend of mine, and she was doing her book launch on the playwright Harold Pinter, who, of course, is with her mother.
Mm.
And she was dressed in your 1970s jumper, the Vermilion one, and she looked totally wonderful. And it's interesting, it's not really about jumpers with words on them. I mean, it is that, but you're offering something completely different. You're offering a lot of spirit and a lot of story in a fairly simple garment. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, it extends, doesn't it? It's not just clothes. You've got interior design and you've also got perfumes and cushions and all sorts of things, all in the same spirit. I wonder how you would really define your own style. I mean, I like to say that it's a sort of a secret fight between classic and perversive. That sounds dramatic, doesn't it? Am I right?
You're right. I love that. It's good. I wrote this press release sometime in the 90s. I used to sort of put all my intensity into finding different ways to describe things. And I called what I did upmarket irreverence. And oh. I think that's what you're suggesting. And when I'm asked that, I think, yeah, I hope that's what I still want to do. I think classy is very good, you know, kind of backstory of elegance, you know, Paris. But for me, Paris also means Lady Penelope from the Thunderbirds. You know, that different, how people get to places via other places is what makes things interesting.
And you're also so tied to the 1970s. It just quite surprises me because my life was so different in that period. But it really is a defining decade, your moment, isn't it? Is that how you feel? Is it a lasting love, or is it a period of reference so that you can, in a changing world, have something that's got a theme to it? But where does it all come from?
Well, it's so full of fun, the 1970s. And also the 70s, I like that they were influenced by the 30s, and they were so, just so glamorous. And so then in the 70s, there was something kind of, you know, some of it was so crude. And then these amazing people emerged, like people I've been very influenced by, like Anita Pallenberg, who started to sort of disseminate formality. And I've always been interested in that. My first kind of obsession was Coco Chanel. And she did so much of that, of undoing, but giving something else as in its place. And I liked the way that she introduced sportswear and sort of boyish things for women while keeping things very feminine, and also having these sort of strict codes of elegance that you never had brown hands. You know, she would sunbathe in gloves but have a brown face, you know, and just these little, multiple little details that we in the fashion world, we love that stuff. These codes that are broken too. Someone who finds a good way to change something up or break a tradition, when it's done well, it's just heart-stopping.
But I'm rather intrigued by the fact that you might be Coco Chanel as your first and greatest love, but also you had relationships in terms of work and inspiration by all sorts of people. I mean, let's take singer-songwriter Nick Cave. And that was a way in which you were very inspired. And are there other collaborations on the way? Maybe his wife, Susie Cave?
Well, certainly with Susie, she's one of my dearest and long-standing friends. And friendship is a big, important thing in my life. And also her sort of incredible beauty and her originality. She used to model for me and I would do fittings on her. So I felt, you know, very... not just as a friendship thing, but her whole being was so inspiring and interesting. And then now I make suits for Nick sometimes when he wants. Mm. He's the only bit of menswear, him and Eric Cantona. And I, you know, it's so honouring to be chosen by Nick, who is so specific, and Susie, who is incredibly... you know, discerning. She really is. We did a collaboration, I think in 2010, just, you know, tiny, tiny collection. And I was really intrigued by how she knew exactly what kind of, you know, how high or low the neck. It was so specific where the sleeve came to on the wrist. Everything, things had to be incredibly short, but the neck was just round the throat so that it gave the best kind of stem, you know, like the stem of a lily to emerge from this little tiny container. Yeah, I've always loved doing collaborations, actually, because partly artistically, when I decided to go back to making films, when I gave up doing fashion shows, and I thought I would be able to communicate better through making films, so I did these collaborative films with John Malkovich, and we made three short films together, which was really great fun, and I did more films after that. And then in terms of like other fashion brand or collaborations in artistic ones, you know, to do with product, I'm in the second collaboration with King and Magor, who do prints, and they do a lot of the posters and museum shops for artists' estates, and they also do other things. And one of the things is with my artworks, I do everything. I draw, I always have a sketchbook on me all the time, which I put everything into. Sometimes dreams, drawings, I don't know, it's full of stuff.
I love being shown your book that you seem to take it everywhere. You've taken it out of your bag there. You literally take it every day.
Yeah.
So if you're inspired, you take out your pencil, yes? And
always. I've got a pencil that I like. I've got these postal code books, which have a tiny, this sort of bluey-green colour and these tiny grids. I feel like my drawings come out best on that, so I always have those. They're made in Japan. And even if I go to a concert, I'll take it in case I hear a good word in a song, and I'll draw it. So I never write it because it doesn't sort of imprint itself in my system. I have to do my drawing of a word so it sort of is embedded. So I've done this collaboration with King and Magor where they go back to the page, and we've done these prints, this limited edition prints and things, which I really enjoy. And I've got some other collaborations coming out next year, which I can't say now, but I'm excited about.
So Serge Gainsbourg has featured a lot in your things that you've designed, especially sweaters. And of course, now people are remembering and thinking again and again of this exceptional person. And in Paris, his home is open now to the public, and I understand there are people who wait in lines outside to go in. What is the attraction? What is the storyline?
I've always been fascinated by his looks, his songs, his words, his personality, you know, everything about him. And also with Jane Birkin, who was a sort of perfect foil for him. And then I made a sweater that said Ginsburg is God on the front. And because John Malkovich and I have made this funny film, this film about beatniks, beatnik girls waiting for their literary hero to arrive, who never arrives. But I wanted one of them to be wearing a kind of like a merchandise, and it ended up saying Ginsburg is God. And then I got a message from Jane Birkin's agent, I think, saying, Jane Birkin wants one of your Ginsburg is God jumpers. So I thought, well, I can't just do anyone's God. It has to mean something. And so I thought about when I was at school, we had these wooden desks, and I would carve in the words of things that matched to me, mostly kind of Bob Marley lyrics. And then I thought, okay, so I drew it something that said, je t'aime Jane, because it was sort of crushy like you have at school. And then I put Ginsburg is God on the back, and I put Serge on the arm, so it was wearing your heart on your sleeve. And so I made something that I felt was completely authentic to that, and it sort of went via Ginsburg is God and came out for Jane and Serge, and that was the story. And then I sent her some, and then I got a message from her saying, oh, I can't possibly wear something saying je t'aime Jane. Maybe I'll give it to my daughters. No, they can't. And there was this kind of, you know, she was just rambling on the answer machine. It was just so lovely. And that was the story of that.
Well, just a few little words with so much behind them.
Yeah.
Thing of having something with depth into it, you somehow have made it true in the world of fashion, which is normally thought of as the opposite, something very shallow that just goes to the top. But I mean, something like your wedding dress suit, the trouser suit that you offered for weddings, it's just like the one that Bianca Jagger famously wore to marry Mick. Do you feel that you've keyed into a certain attitude, that you are able to produce something which is familiar? In other words, someone has made, many people have done trouser suits, but you've made it in a different way. You've put your heart, your soul, your secrets into it.
That's everything I hope for. Some of it comes from being strangely sort of outsider, my whole, not just me, but like my family structure. My parents weren't married in the 60s. That was a big deal. We were, you know, people were very, you know, looked down on us, you know. But I knew that there was no reason for that. So I found ways to feel like I had a way of holding my own and having validity, I suppose. And of all the things to find, you know, as you said, people were very sort of snooty about fashion business, you know, saying it's facile and things, but it's so full of depth. And there are all these friendships very much visible at your birthday party, where people wanted to show how much they care for you and how important you've been in our lives. And when we were standing outside having a sneaky cigarette halfway through the meal, and I think it was me, Jasper, Andreas Krontala, and Michelle Lamy, and Adrian. And we were saying how when you criticised us, it was some of the best moments of our lives, because you saw that we were capable of better, and you said it. So even though it was excruciating at the time, it was an encouragement. And we all kind of said how these were some of your best you know, bits of writing in terms of what we took away.
Well, Bella, this is news for me. Nobody said to me at the time, I loved your review with all those mean things you said about it. They either went to cry in a corner or their bosses came on, rung me up at 8 o'clock in the morning saying, how could I dare to print such rubbish? So anyway, it's very nice to hear that you took it so well.
I mean, at the time, I'm sure I was, you know, like so pained. But in this business, it's about tenacity as well. And if we, you know, sort of survive, you have to hang on in there and work extremely hard. And there is a lot of support within, you know, designers for designers, and it's not really that promoted by industry. You know, all the films, we're all supposed to be so bitchy and competitive, and we are, but we are also incredibly rallying and compassionate towards what people go through.
I've got one last deep and important question. What do you like wearing yourself? What is your penchant? Is it for a uniform and a tie, or is it more with the story of something, somebody who's fascinated you? What inspires you?
Well, I go through phases, but I'm really kind of owning my love of uniform now as I get older. And I've got a shirt and tie in my collection, which now I can repeat as much as I want to because there aren't really any rules. And I find this represents me of being composed and being able to go off the grid, because my uniform will get me into where I want to go, and then I can mess around and be a bit of a rebel.
Bella, thank you so much for inviting me to your store, and it's been a joy talking to you, but also a joy looking at all these lovely things that everybody's rushing to buy. And it's so interesting for me to be able to understand from you, thanks to you, what the depth of meaning of so many of the pieces that look so simple as you walk through the door of your small store in London. So congratulations in doing what everybody dreams of doing, which is making clothes that are simple to wear, stylish to wear, and at the same time have a great deep thought behind them.
Thank you, Susie, for coming here. It's my honour.
Bella, your life connected to your creative designs makes an extraordinary story. I long to see this little girl dressed in a local look in Marrakesh, and those fascinating references to 1970. A story in every stitch. Join me next time, where the episode will be from Giorgio Armani. Creative Conversations with Susie Menkes is produced by Natasha Cowan, music by Jörg Zuber, graphics by Paul Wallace, and edited by Tim Thornton. To find my articles, visit susiemenkes.com and susiemenkes on Instagram. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please do rate, review, subscribe, and tell your friends. You can find me on all the usual channels.